started to kind of see what this is away.
Right, exactly.
First of all, welcome to our committee meeting, and I would like to excuse Mark's daughter, who chairs this committee, who's not able to be with us today, and he asked that I chair it today. The Finance and Facilities Committee today, looking at some items, tab E through tab L. And we're going to begin the discussion highlighting the revenues and expenditures over the last 4 years of the system. And I'm going to just turn the time over to Associate Commissioner Henry to lead that discussion.
Fantastic. So good morning, everyone. I'll stand and talk through this, and then if you have questions along the way. So this discussion this morning is more of a high-level discussion that looks at the expenses and revenues for 17-18 over 16-17. In your packet, you have information for the previous 4 years as well. But one of the things is we start to engage in a broader conversation about the cost of higher education. I wanted to give you a sense of what our revenues are, where they're coming from, and how we're using them, and then open up the conversation about what additional topics do you want to start to cover as we dig a little bit further into this topic. So with respect to higher ed, we all know that higher education is a large enterprise. In fact, if you take all of USHE, which includes UESP, UHEO, the hospitals and clinics from the University of Utah, and all eight of the institutions, we are the largest employer in the state of Utah. We have over 40,000 employees. We own 33.8 million square feet across the state. We have an appropriated budget, and we'll focus our efforts on that, and that's what the legislature cares about, of $1.9 billion. When you add in the University of Utah Hospital and Clinics and some of the other revenue sources with grants and contracts, we're a $6.7 billion entity. You can see in terms of the top six employers, according to DWS for 2017, when you combine all of USHE together, we're the top. IHC follows us, the state of Utah after that, BYU, which is, again, another education entity, Walmart, and then Hill Air Force Base. When you look at the population comparison, Salt Lake City proper has about 181,000 people. USHE, between our employees and our students, we're 220,000 people. So again, we are an enterprise that it takes a lot of money, a lot of effort, a lot of time, and our greatest assets are the faculty and staff that we have to help our students make it through the process. So when we talk about our appropriated revenue budget, we have $1.9 billion that the legislature appropriated to us in FY18. Of that, 48.8% were actually tax funds. We get both general fund and education fund. Last year's mix was $261 million in the general fund, which is sales tax, and $676 million in education fund, which is the income tax. And what you'll see is we have 43% of our appropriated budget coming from tuition, some smaller sources with other dedicated credits, sales and services of our auxiliaries, and then we have 7.2% of carry forward balances. Regent policy allows institutions to carry forward between 4 to 7% to make sure that they are financially sound for the coming year. We don't want them to spend 100% of their dollars every single year. So you'll see that number basically stay between 7 to 9% for the system over time. When we talk about where the revenue lies, this is, I think, an important thing for the regents to be aware of. 35% of the $1.9 billion is at the University of Utah. $672 million is appropriated to their line. Now, this doesn't include the hospitals or anything along those lines. 97% of all of the appropriated funds that come to the system go right back out to the institutions to support students. 3% comes to the commissioner's office, and of that 3%, 54% of those dollars are used to support Regent scholarships and other student financial aid programs. 34% go back out to the institutions, whether it's through Academic Library Consortium, the cybersecurity, heady and technology initiatives, and things that we're doing with concurrent enrollment. And 12% of that 3% is what is used to actually manage the commissioner's office and the staff and the work that we do. When we talk about new revenues received for FY18, this is kind of a different snapshot for you to take a look at. We received in new ongoing and one-time tax funds $61.2 million. That's pretty significant with respect to the dollars that flow into the system. Of that, the state-funded compensation package, which is 75% of the total authorized amount, was $25.8 million. The Board of Regents budget priorities received $17.6 million. The legislative priorities, now these are programs, whether it's Engineering Initiative, whether it's the State Workforce Investment Board, whether it's the Talent Ready Incentive Program. So not necessarily things that the board asked for, but the legislature has asked for when it impacts instruction is $9.5 million. And then we have our non-instruction related programs. Poison Control, Safe UT, Huntsman Cancer Center, those types of things where money comes in from the state to support it, but it isn't necessarily supporting this instruction of students. But you can see if we were started to break down the cost impact of those new dollars coming in, that additional dollar per FTE amount is listed below. We tend to spend the money you give us. You increase our budget by 5%, our expenses will increase also by 5%. And so it kind of drives this conversation around cost. Why does higher ed keep getting more expensive? Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that, but we use the dollars to fulfill our mission. And as we grow, it becomes more expensive to serve those students because we're growing the infrastructure to go along with it. With respect to the new tuition fee revenue that the system received, that $43 million is a very big number. When we came to you in March, the number that you would have seen is about $28,651,000. That's related to the rate increase and the existing student population when we set the tuition a year ago. With the new student growth, we had 2,100 additional FTE above and beyond where we thought we would be. So there is $15.5 million of additional tuition revenue that came into the system for this year that we just wrapped up. When we talk about how we use our dollars, we look at it in two ways. We look at it by function and we look at it by category of expense. This first one is by function. How much money do we spend on instruction? How much money do we spend on student support? How much are we spending on institution support, which is your business operations, your HR, those types of things, and facilities, et cetera. 93% of the appropriated the largest expenditure for our system is within the instruction of students and support of faculty and students. So 46, 10, and 7 with respect to student services, academic support, and the direct instruction of students. So that is where the majority of our money is actually going, to spend on the instruction of students. When we talk about the support services that go behind that, that represents about 25% of the work that is being done. And then you can see some of the other smaller categories as well. When we talk about the largest cost driver, it's people. 76% of all of the money that we receive goes to support employees' salary, wages, and benefits. As those costs increase, or as we add additional people, that's where the costs of higher education continue to increase. 24% of our other funds are used to support current expense, travel, equipment, and those types of items. Yes, we see some cost increases associated with that, but where the majority of our budget is actually with people, it makes it very difficult to start to say, how do we start to cut where we can? Not that we can't, we can look at the current expense categories and say, can we squeeze a little bit more out of there? Can we be a little bit more efficient? The conversation around shared services, where could we potentially save if we go that direction? Common IT platforms, those types of things. But with respect to the big dollars, it's all in salary and personnel. When we talk about the cost increases over FY17, the majority of the cost increases happened in instruction. We grew our personnel, we grew our faculty as a result, so those costs increased as a result of that as well. When you look across the board, the total expenses increased 5.4%. That aligns with the increase in total revenue that we received for that particular year. Even though we don't spend 100% of our dollars every year, the spending pattern follows the revenue pattern. When we talk about the categories, you can see salaries and wages increased 2.7% over the previous year. The other big one is the current expense one. And again, this is a big chunk of scholarship dollars. We received a contribution for the Regent Scholarship in that particular year. Also, in terms of our benefits that year. You can see it's almost a full percent increase over the previous year with respect to the amount spent. And then you've got your IT, just your cost escalations with software licenses, and as we start to look at where we can become more efficient, those types of things.
Just a question about that slide, because they had the components add up to the total of 5.4.
Correct.
Which suggests to me that the components are actually a percentage, like salaries and wages isn't the increase in salaries and wages. Is that salaries and wages the increase as a
as the budget, so
relative to the total?
Correct, from the previous year.
So salaries and wages increase is 2.7 percentage points of the 5.4 percentage points of increase. Is that?
It's the total, so the total expenses, so taking last year's to this year's comparison,
yep.
It was 5.4% last year to this year's comparison just for the salary and benefits line. That line increased the 2.7. So when you add it up, that's how the 5.4% comes into place in that direction.
I mean, because if each of the components is increasing at a rate less than 5.4, how does the total increase at 5.4?
So it's, I had broader categories in here that actually have the numbers, which I can show you kind of that.
Maybe we do it offline, because I might be missing something. But.
Okay.
I understand what you're saying. I have the same question.
Okay. That's easy.
What you're saying is you should take the increase and what percent that is in the total amount, and then weight that, and then average it out.
I'm thinking that the 2.7 of salary is actually 2.7 over 5.4 times 5.4. Let's see, so it would be.
So here's the math behind that. So our expenditures, total expenditures, were $1.7 billion in 17. In 18, they were almost $1.8 billion.
Yeah.
So this $91 million represents that 5.4% increase over the previous year. So that 2.7.
Yeah, what I'm saying is salaries and wages, though, increased 4.9%. See, 938 to 984 isn't a 2.7% change.
So the 46 against the 938.
Yes. So if in 2000, just take the first line. Salaries and wages were 938. They went to 984, a $46 million change. That's actually a 4.9% increase. It's 2.7% of the $1,704,000,000.
Right.
But it's not a. I think it's misleading.
Okay.
Most of us would look at numbers.
We can correct that as well. But in terms of 67% of the expense is of that $91 million. 67% is the salary, wage and benefits. So to get to the 5.4 represents that portion of it.
Yeah, it's 2.7 percentage points of 5.4 percentage points.
But, correct.
Yeah, that's but.
We can frame however you want to do this. This is just again trying to get a broader perspective.
Most people would read it across and just say, how much does salaries and wages increase? That says 2.7, but it's not 2.7. It's actually total salaries and wages increased 4.9%.
Right.
And you have to redo the math on all of them, I think, to make it.
To get to the 100% across the bottom. Yeah.
And then total expenses increased 5.4.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Kimberly?
Yes.
Two-thirds of the cost really going to salaries and benefits. How does that compare to public ed? Do we know that?
So in the education sector, you'll usually see 75% of all of your expenses. And we're with the service industry, 75% of all of the expenditures tend to be salary and benefit related, and 25% of the other. If you were to look at the commissioner's office specifically, we're a little bit different than that because a lot of the money we have is current expense and it goes back out, which is more representative of what you would see out in the industry with somebody that's like a manufacturing organization type of thing. So public ed, because the majority of their expenses is people, they're going to be similar to what we are.
Yeah. Okay.
The other thing that we want to make sure that you are aware of and recognize is that institutions annually are looking at ways to decrease their, okay, we'll go with this one first. In terms of the number of students that the system took on, in terms of headcount, they took 11,000 more students this year, which was 6.3% with respect just to the number of students. The number of budget-related students, the students that qualify or can be counted towards legislative funding, is the 1.8. Number of degrees and certificates increased by almost 1,100, about 2.9%. The employee changes. One of the questions said in terms of it's not just salary increases that are happening, it's the number of people that we're actually hiring. Over the year, we hired 358 new employees in the system, of which 8 of them were faculty, 157 of them were full-time staff. The executives that are categorized decreased by 7. The building square feet decreased by 74,000. That just means that one of our buildings came offline. And then you can see the average instruction revenue per student headcount, budget-related FTE, and degree and certificate. One of the challenges that we have is how are we demonstrating efficiency? And one of the things that the legislature will say is, well, we want to know, are you driving the cost down for your degrees and certificates on an annual basis? That is all dependent on how much money they give and how many we graduate. You can see the CPI and heavy changes that are listed as well. If we use student headcount, which is more representative of what we're doing in terms of the input, we have more students coming in, we take on additional costs of instructors to teach them, so the more students we have, that's the better metric that we have, and that's historically the one that higher ed is focused on, is the input. The cost per headcount, the cost per FTE kind of thing, not necessarily the cost per degree, because it does take time for that money to cycle through, and this is something that the committee who was here yesterday with UVU was made aware of as well, is we invest early on and develop the infrastructure, and then the students come along through the pipeline, and that starts to draw down the cost per degree and certificate, but that's 4 to 6 years, possibly 8 years for some down the road where we start to see that impact. So you can see the various metrics, and this is one of the challenges that we have with the legislature, because the one that they're really most interested in now is this particular piece, and how we compare to CPI and HEPI with respect to, are our costs growing faster than what the other standard indices are. With respect to staff, the 257 you can see is broken out. Research and public service, they tend to fluctuate quite a bit depending on their resources because they are funded a little bit differently than the other lines for instruction. But you can see, again, instruction and academic and student support, that's where we're hiring the folks, that's where the expenses are occurring, those types of things. With respect to institutional efficiencies and reallocations and cost savings, we're always asking, what are you doing? Are you just coming to us with respect to handout, give us more money, or are the institutions actually doing stuff to make things better and reuse resources and those types of things? Every year we collect information. This is just a sample of what we've collected for this particular year. The institutional efficiencies. Institutions can identify $2.6 million that they have saved as a result of doing energy efficiency projects, expanding online instruction, consolidation of support services. They've reallocated $1.2 million for faculty positions, the idea of putting graduate and online courses, and then an additional $1 million worth of institutional cost savings. A lot of that being realized by rethinking their approach to campus stores, police services, software solutions, et cetera. So we collect this information. It's information that we want to share with the legislature so they know that we're not just asking for more money, but we are actually being more efficient with some of the things that we do. And then finally, one of the questions is, what does next year's potential look like? So we know that we received about 5% additional new revenue. Our expenses will go up about 5% over the current year. And you can see kind of in the various categories. What we don't know yet is the new student growth tuition revenues that we will receive as a result of new students on our campus. We do know that fall enrollment was up, so we would anticipate that there would be some additional flexibility for institutions in that particular category, but we'll be tracking that over the next year. So as we start to have more of a cost conversation, I wanted to give the committee an opportunity to say, what additional topics might you be interested in? with respect to looking at cost. I know shared services has been one of those items that has come up a few different times, and the concept of what does that potentially look like. Are there other topics that we can also help facilitate, and as I work with the business VPs over the next few months as well, what can we do to bring back more information as we dig more deeper into how do we enhance or improve the cost of education?
Kimberly, I don't know if this would be really a topic for discussion, but I found it so interesting that Weber just recently opened the new Lindquist building where they saved, I think, about $8 million by renovating an existing building versus a new building. And I don't know if that's a pattern that we can apply more generally or not, but we have many aging structures, and that would be one thing I would like to talk a little bit more about.
So we can bring back a conversation around the institutional efficiencies with respect to what are they doing with the buildings as well as other operations.
I think that, I think the material is really getting a lot better. So I really appreciate it. And, the material we have doesn't include these slides. I think it would be nice if we got the slides.
Yeah, and I'll make the correction for the ones so it's a little bit clearer in terms of where we're going.
And then the other thing I would just note is I think that the information we do have by institution does not include the healthcare, right?
Correct. It's just the
educational
instruction.
It's educational and I think research.
There's research and public service from the appropriate standpoint. It's not 100% of what they do, but it is what's appropriate by the legislature.
Yeah, I think that personally, I think if we also at least annually had kind of just a separate tab on the healthcare. I mean, that's a huge operation, and ultimately part of the system by being part of the University of Utah. So I think it would be well for us to have some understanding as to kind of what that picture looks like.
There's a financial tab in the data book that has the hospital.
Okay.
Yeah, we can make sure that there's a presentation.
Right. We'd be happy to do that. We have
even just a summary page in here, just to show that we're becoming in a formal setting. We're being exposed to it. Would be a good thing.
Along the same lines, it'd be good to see best examples, best practices of efficiencies that have been found in the Utah system of higher education. There's a lot of debate about the rising inflation and higher. Examples I think I've heard more of is, Western governors use universities or BYU, Idaho, or Clayton Christensen's latest book, and everybody in the room's back goes rigid when they hear these examples. But I know there have been a lot of really good things that have happened in the system that have really made a difference. So to spend a little bit of time talking about best practices here that have worked that, other institutions might be able to benefit from as well.
If I may add to that, I think it is an important point to look at best practices and really deconstruct them. Because I personally hear very conflicting, and then I'm reading Clay Christensen's book. And so it may give us some clarity when we really look at these models, the efficacy, the actual completion, the actual employment. Could you do it all online? What are they doing entirely online versus not online? And because I think it is where we begin to really kind of get into the nuances of what's really working versus much touted best practice. And when you dig deep, the information can be quite conflicting. But at the system level, we could, if you could bring us some of that clarity, it would be so helpful.
I think a lot of those lines, but I just mentioned that we've been having some discussion with the presidents. I know that our commissioner is with the staff. On the shared services issue, I think there's a growing awareness, recognition that there's a lot that can be done. It needs a lot of homework done, and it needs to be done by the right. I mean, it's going to take some staffing to do it, but there are a lot of areas where we ought to be exploring what the cost savings could be by by sharing services across the system. Services that don't really pertain to the mission of the institution, they're truly back office kinds of services, and that's something I think increasingly we'll find ourselves talking about.
So we'll incorporate more of these elements just as a conversation piece for this committee as we start to dig into it, and then hopefully as we progress policies, practices, directions for the institution. So move forward. So the materials will be posted to the website. I'm going to make the adjustments so it's a little bit clearer on the spreadsheet, and then we'll make sure.
Thanks. Dr. Henry, as we have indicated, we'll be having these discussions in future meetings, and I think they're very, very helpful. We have two action items that we need to consider today. The first one is found on tab F, Utah Valley University, their campus master plan amendment, and Val Peterson is here to lead that discussion.
Thank you, Regent Anderson. As you know, 2 years ago, we had a major revision of our master plan here at Utah Valley University, and as such, we don't have a lot of revisions that we're bringing forward today. We continue to work on what we outlined 2 years ago, some additional properties at Vineyard this morning. The bridge that we anticipate starting construction in March was in front of the Transportation Commission and received its final approval. And so as I talk about master plan, I'll talk about some of the things that we see. Obviously, the first revision that we're asking for today is the Bastion home. Lake Mount Manor was donated to the campus this last fall. It's a 7-acre property that's to the south of the campus. It's a 40,000 square foot home, and it's going to be a great addition to our arts community. And so we're really excited about this. That piece of property needed to be added to our master plan. The second revision that we were asking for was to move the master plan line to 925 South. And last night, Cameron Martin, our Vice President for University Relations, was meeting with the neighborhood and discussing that. And after that discussion this morning, we decided to put a pause on that request while we continue to dialogue with the neighborhood and to try to come to some mutual agreements on the direction we'd like to see in the future. And so the only revision that we're truly asking for is the Bastion home. And then the second thing that's part of our campus master plan is the Performing Arts Building. We just finished construction on that. It actually opened for classes January 6th, and we thought we'd show you a video, a 60-second clip of the construction of that building and how exciting it is to see that piece get added to the comprehensive nature of Utah Valley University. So that building has been envisioned on this campus for the last 20 years, and so as that comes to fruition, it will change the nature of our arts community at the university and throughout Utah County, and so we're excited about what it brings to our campus. Practice rooms, a 900-seat concert hall where the Utah Symphony will perform here in Utah County. It has state-of-the-art tunability. You literally can change the panel so you can get the sound just the way you want it. It's a pretty amazing facility. our 501-seat theater, choral area, dance area. It's got a recording studio. And so we're really excited about that. Our students are in it. The excitement that it's brought is amazing, and we've actually sold out our first event that's going to be in the concert hall. And so we have Terry Crews there and coming this spring, and that's already sold out. So it's a tremendous asset to the campus, and it really has invigorated the arts on our campus. Pedestrian bridge, this is something that we've been working through. The legislature provided support for this 2 years ago. We've worked through some design revisions, and I think we're finally to the point where you'll see groundbreaking in March. We anticipate that we'll open that for the fall of 2020. And that's just going to be a tremendous asset from the standpoint that the Front Runner Station on this campus is on the other side of the freeway. And so this really takes care of the last mile, and it literally almost is, it's a 951-foot span across the freeway. And so it's a very long bridge. But we have right now between 3,500 and 5,000 students a day who are riding Front Runner to this campus. So it will allow them to be able to walk the campus. It will also connect the 8,000 rooms that are across the freeway to this campus, as well as the West Campus where our Health Professions College is located. So it will be exciting as we watch this span across I-15, and we look forward to when we get to open it. And then we have the Sorensen Center remodel, which you've already approved. That'll go to the legislature for approval during this session, $24.5 million remodel. We're doing some planning right now. We anticipate the construction on that will happen in 2 years from now. And then, of course, something that you've never heard about, but that would be the Woodbury School of Business Building. That is our number one priority on this campus. We have the largest business school in the system, one out of every four business students in the state of Utah that graduate actually come out of this school. And we're excited about that request and what the transformation will be on this campus on the south side of the university. And so with that, we'll be open to any questions anyone might have.
If there are no further questions, I'll entertain a motion to approve this update of their master plan.
So moved.
Second it?
Second.
Okay, that has been approved. The next item we have is found. Oh, thanks,
Thank you,
Dr. Peterson.
Appreciate it.
Okay. The next one. Oh, I'm sorry. We need a formal vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. So it's been approved. Thanks. Keep me on track. Any opposed? So the next item is found on tab G. The University of Utah has a proposal to build a golf training facility with non-state funds, and we'll turn it over to Robin Bird after that presentation.
Thank you. You should also, at the table, have a little one-page handout if that will help. So we are requesting your approval to build a golf team building. What it will do for us is it will provide an indoor training facility for seasons when our team members can't be out on the actual golf course. It'll give us a way to centralize our golf program operations, which are now spread in various buildings, create team space, which we don't have, and we believe that this building will become a beautiful little focal center and help us in future recruitment. A small 6,000 square feet, a pretty simple building, which you'll see in the next picture. Has a putting and chipping area, has a simulator area since we can't replicate a whole golf course inside, and then support spaces for the team as well as a hall of honor. We evaluated many sites across campus and came up with the one that made the most sense. It is on Guardsman Way at Pitt South. It's a little piece of land that actually sits adjacent to our indoor tennis training center and our football center and indoor football training facility. So we're beginning to have a nice lineup of athletics. It gives us the opportunity to share support and facilities across the different buildings. The plan is very simple, a little rectangle that is two stories high in the open bay for putting and chipping, and a little stacked space where the office and support areas will go. Simple little boarding buildings sitting at the corner of the site, which allows room for other things to come to the is $2.5 million, and as noted previously, 100% donor funded. And in terms of the schedule, as soon as we complete approvals, we should be able to open within 14 months. And that is it. Questions? Yes.
My understanding is that the University of Utah does not have a women's golf team. Is that correct?
That is correct.
The only Pac-12 school that does not. Is that correct?
Correct. And I know there is interest, and I know there's work going on around that area. I'm not athletics. I'm not really facilities. And I think our athletics director is off with the team right now. So it is an area of interest for the university. I don't know, Kathy, if you know more than I do.
I haven't heard that one discussed, but it's a very good point. I'm sure there would be interest in that.
For the women's restrooms in the building, I guess.
That's understood.
Large ones.
Is it designed that for a future women's team?
I don't think so, but we do have adjacent land if we need to expand the building or the space. Looking back at that site, it's a very small building on a pretty generous site, so the actual building takes up this much area, could easily be mirrored or doubled or expanded.
Do you know how many simulator bays there are? Is it just a single?
I don't. It shows it here. It actually like one. And I'm not an expert on simulators, so I don't know. Any additional questions? Yes.
No, I think it's a good point to bring up. And before the building's built, I wonder if it would be cost effective to look at just a simple redesign that wouldn't require building new structures down the road another year.
We can certainly, I will bring that up with our athletic director as we go forward. I'm not sure the design is all complete yet.
This is really as far as the design has gone.
So there's certainly opportunity.
I think it's so far as to suggest that we approve it conditioned upon receiving a representation from the university that it would accommodate women's golf program.
Future women's program. I think that's
right. Just kind of a way to acknowledge that perspective anyway. I think it's one of the ways we can kind of encourage that kind of thing.
And we'd be happy to come back with an update.
Is that a motion?
Yeah, I'll make that motion.
We assume the university would come up with additional donated funds.
Yes, it will remain.
Or even just to acknowledge that this would, you know, that this would meet the need for both the men's and women's.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the space for practice is adequate, but I don't know is about the office and support.
Right, and since this is as far as design has gone, that's certainly something that we can discuss. I mean, adding locker restroom facilities is basically what you're talking about to accommodate women as well as men's team.
Take a very small change to accommodate women's support space. Plus another simulator may be
out. I mean, I think it's sounding, adding women sounds like a great idea, but at the same time, there's probably a whole lot of thought in the Title IX allocation and what sports, and it gets really complicated really fast. So
you're correct, there is. So we're not saying that we could
end this or condition it on that, but just ask the question.
Right, and so I think
it's appropriate. Maybe there's a whole other reason, and they're doing other things in other sports with the
And unfortunately, I'm not the expert, but I think we could fairly come back and share with you what it would take to accommodate women in the city.
Or what the plan is.
Right. We can certainly bring that back to you. Yes, the question would be is, you know, as this moves through, are we putting this on hold until we bring that back or get something to you before we move this on to the building board?
I mean, my only point in asking that question is that golf seems to be something that's extremely important in the business world, mm-hmm. equalizing women into the culture. So, I mean, that's the reason I hope it's asking.
Yeah, interesting. So, with the motion to clarify, we want to approve the facility project with the condition that the university come back and provide an update or a plan on future women's golf program.
Future accommodation for a women's program.
Yeah,
if they so choose or something.
Yeah, at least maybe just to inform us, because I'm sensitive to what Bob is saying. I don't think the intenders try and slow it down. It's really just to ask them to come back and engage in some dialogue, make sure that they're thinking about it. And
absolutely.
I bet they are. Yeah.
All in favor of this motion, say aye.
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 Any opposed? So that's passed. The last items are all information items, and we have they're found on tabs H through L. And so we'll just go through each one of these now. We'll start with tab H, which is the University of Utah a trustee property disposal item, and we will turn that over to Dr. Henry to present.
Fantastic. So region policy allows the trustees to take action on property transactions, both acquisitions and disposals, up to $500,000. The University of Utah is just notifying the board that the Board of Trustees approved the disposal of a condominium that was gifted to the university, which has an appraised value of $185,000 at its November 2018 meeting. There's no action, it's just for your awareness.
Okay, and the second item is the UCHI space utilization report for 2017 and 18, and we'll have turn that over to Assistant Commissioner Rick Jammin and Dr. Henry to answer questions.
So this is tab I, if you want to look at the report. This has been a lot of work from the institutions, which acknowledge that they have done a tremendous job in putting this together. So this report fulfills the requirement that by the regents in the March meeting, you adopted a policy R5751 that requires an annual report, and so this is that tab, of all the institutions on metrics, but also a report. So there's a narrative portion on each of the institutions in this report. The policy also requires central scheduling of classrooms and labs, and so I'll report on that as well as where we're at in that that follow-up. And it affirms, kind of going back to the conversation earlier this morning about the efficiency, there's the system goal to efficiently use our space, and this is one of the ways that we are addressing that is the Commissioner's Office of Board of Regents looking at these metrics. So just as some background, as you look through the report, you'll come across these metrics that were adopted by the regents in that meeting. So room utilization, so RUR, there's always an acronym, right? But room utilization is how many hours per week is a room in use. So this room, how many hours is this room being used in any given week on average? And then there's the seat occupancy. So not only how many hours is this used, but how many seats are full. So in this case, there's maybe 60 seats. We have 30 occupied, so it'd be 50% occupancy. And then what we're doing is we're looking at classrooms and teaching labs. So two different types of space, a little bit different, and hence there's a little different standards that have been put in place. And you can see what those are there. So on pages 4 and 5 of your report, it has kind of the UCHI system-wide metrics for classrooms and laboratories. So the blue chart represents classroom utilization in terms of weekly hours, and you can see where institutions are in terms of the standard that has been set, which is just a little under 34 hours per week. The yellow orange shows seat occupancy for classroom buildings. And then on page 5, the same thing but for laboratories. So green is again the weekly rate, which the standard's 25, just a little under 25 hours per week. Recognizing that laboratories have different usage than classrooms. And also the seat occupancy rates, so are in the yellow boxes, graphs. And as you go through the report, you'll find that each institution has these charts. So starting on page 11, that for the University of Utah, and then every institution shows where they're at. We've included last year's metrics that we're using a little bit different of a data approach, but back in January of last year, institutions proposed some of the initial data usage, and so for utilization. So we've included that here. The idea is that next year, as we collect more data, this will become a historical look, and we'll drop off last year's data because it's not maybe as comparable to this year's. And going forward, and new this year, we have a table for every institution, for both classrooms and for laboratories, that shows every building in their institution that deals with classrooms or laboratories. Shows how many rooms they have available, the seats available, and their utilization by building. And this is kind of the part that I just wanted to report back on. In the summary section of the report, I highlight some of the challenges that institutions have with utilization. That this should be the beginning of the conversation. We don't want this to be the end-all of, here's the metric that we use to punish or reward institutions, but it should be one of the pieces that we look at. And there's really talking to the institutions, and in their narrative reports, we ask them, what are some of the challenges that you have in fully utilizing all of your facilities? And there's really six themes that came out that I've put up here on the presentation. Specialization of space, particularly laboratories. You know, it's difficult to use a chemistry lab for, you know, dance. Those kind of issues, particularly with labs. With classrooms, a very common observation was functional obsolescence, or the technology as well as the facility itself, the age, don't accommodate either the classroom participation or the new forms of teaching. And so because of that, kind of leads into the third one, there's low student or faculty demand for older facilities because it doesn't necessarily meet their needs. Some of the other comments that they made that made utilization a challenge were non-traditional part-time student schedules, that even though we would like to use a room for, you know, 24 or maybe even 18 hours a day, 12 hours a day, student demand dictates a lot of this, especially on regional institutions and community colleges. ADA is a smaller issue, but it is kind of limited to some of those older buildings where, you know, from a central scheduling standpoint, it makes it more difficult to accommodate just because you don't know who's going to be in that class. So when it's decentralized, there's the ability to maybe use some of that space more because you know who exactly in your department would need the accommodation that room may or may not have. From a central scheduling, it's difficult to maybe schedule a certain room that doesn't have accommodations because they just don't know in any given semester.
Do we know how much space we have that's not ADA compliant?
I don't. Yeah. That's a good question. It is one of the top categories that we look at for improvement dollars, and is to do improvement projects that's considered life safety.
Is something that we could potentially pose as a question to the institutions, though, to say how
it might be useful to know, because it might help inform how we, because of the simple scheduling challenge they have with it.
Yeah, that's a great idea. We can get some more information around that. And then the final challenge is summer. Summer is hands down across the institutions, you'll see lower utilization just because of vacation or work experiences, which are as important as the classroom. Part of the policy was to require institutional central scheduling, which is a big challenge and a big order for some of our institutions. And so this slide is meant to report back on where they are on that piece of the policy. So five of our institutions have either historically been central scheduled or have moved there in the last several years. So the University of Utah, Southern Utah, Dixie State, Utah Valley, and Salt Lake Community College are 100% centrally scheduled of classrooms and laboratories that we are measuring in our metrics. Utah State is really close on the classroom side, although their laboratories are primarily decentralized, the department use. They're in the process, and they have the goal of central scheduling all of that by fiscal 2020. Snow College is at 60%, and with a goal to be in compliance by the spring to bring the rest of the 40 up into central schedule through a committee that they will have that will help allocate that space. And then Weber State probably has the biggest challenge. They've historically been decentralized, and so this is a pretty big change for their campus, their academics. But they are well underway. That they have a new software solution that they're working towards for 19, and then they're hopeful to be at 100% completion by 2020. So moving everyone towards central scheduling will give a little bit more control over that space and to help improve some of the utilization, especially with software solutions and scheduling. And then finally, where are we going from here with this information? That we will continue to report this annually and show where institutions are at. There's the thought to incorporate this into the prioritization process as we look at capital development prioritization, as well as the legislation that was considered earlier in Senator Milner's bill. It highlights utilization twice, actually, in both pieces of the hybrid model. And then region metrics, which I'll just highlight here. As part of that discussion you'll have later today, one of the metrics that will be measured going forward is utilization for classrooms, which is a combination of the room use and the seat occupancy, with kind of a goal of 22.5 for most institutions. SGU has a high goal to improve that to 32, and so that will be something we track going forward as well. So with that, happy to entertain any questions or discussion.
Any questions? Well, thanks very much for that information. Let's move on to tab J, and this is the initial report of auxiliary enterprise operations, and then we'll transition over to Dr. Kennedy.
Fantastic. So this item is our annual report to just let you know how our schools, is associated with housing, food service, their campus stores, and their student centers are performing. Based on the analysis and the work that we've done in reviewing the financial information that's been audited by the institutions and sent to the commissioner's office, all of the institutions are in a financially healthy, positive position. There are some changes that USU will be doing to eliminate its campus store. The price and blending will restructure that because of some losses in revenue, the decreases in the student population. But overall, we are in a healthy position, and the institution's auxiliary services are doing great overall.
All right. Any questions? Let's move on to tab K, and this is the USU annual report on institutional and revenue bond indebtedness. And again, we'll turn it over to Dr. Henry.
So this is, an annual report on the level of institutional revenue bond indebtedness. There's key information that's highlighted in the report regarding the $1.3 billion of revenue bonds that are outstanding as of June 30th. The Commissioner's Office staff has reaffirmed that the bonds are being retired on schedule and the debt service requirements are being met or exceeded in every case. I also want to specifically call out the notice that Regents received in a few weeks ago by a week ago with respect to the auditor, the state auditor, regarding Snow College. The auditor visited the Snow College and expressed that he had concerns that Snow College may be in a position to default on their bonds. He had overstated his concern with respect to the consequences of what was going on. Ultimately, the issue was that the state auditor could not complete Snow's financial audit by the January 31st timeframe without Snow College completing some financial tasks that needed to be addressed on their campus. It in no way leads them to be in a position of default. They have made their bond payment. They are financially sound. They have the reserves in place. They have since corrected all of the missing and provided all of the missing information to the state auditors. We do have Kelly Murdoch here as well as Jake Dettinger if there are questions specifically for Snow College, and then being compliant with the continuing disclosure requirement. But again, Snow College is healthy, it's fine, there's no question, no concern about the performance on their bonds. The auditor just was a little excited and misspoke and created some chaos that probably just have been created. So.
Any questions? No, thanks again for that. And one more, tab L, the U-Sheet 2019 data book update, and again, we'll turn it over to Dr. Henry.
So one of the things that our office has done and has done since 1987 is publish an annual data book, which looks at a significant number of key metrics and elements associated with enrollment, tuition, degrees and certificates awarded, financial information. We've published every data book since 1987. We've got them all posted on our website. This is something that we update on an annual basis. We want to make sure that you are aware. It is based, it drives a lot of the reports that we provide. It comes directly from the institutions. We work with them to validate that information. It is posted, and this is just to let you know that if you want to read 200 pages worth of higher ed data, we have it available for you, and it's ready to go.
Well, I don't think we have any other items, and I think we're finishing early. So we've made up our time, and you can take a little break. We'll be gathering up in room 213 at 12:15 for lunch.
Yes.
Anything else?
Just a reminder that students will be joining you for lunch, so please try to be on time at 12:15, and we're in AMB. And then also, for those that were not able to attend, the next deep dive budget review is for Utah State University on February 25th, which is